Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Tonight's presidential debate in Cleveland will be the first time that President Trump and Joe Biden face each other on stage. And it will be one of the last times that both candidates have a national platform to define each other and themselves. That's because voting is already underway in many states. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith is in Cleveland, and she joins us now. Tam, set the scene for us. First of all, there's going to be an audience tonight.
Yeah, not much of one. It will be socially distanced, much smaller audience than we have seen in past debates. But there will be some people in the audience. I've been in Cleveland now for a few hours. There are planes with signs behind them flying overhead. I saw a truck with anti-Trump messages on it driving around where the press hotels are. But it's largely around the area of the Cleveland Clinic where the debate is happening. It's pretty much on lockdown around here. A lot of security. And we all had to go get COVID tests.
Oh, interesting. It's going to be a 90-minute debate. Chris Wallace of Fox News will be the host. Six topics will be covered: the Trump and Biden records, the Supreme Court, COVID-19, the economy, race and violence in the cities, and the integrity of the election. How does the format favor one candidate over the other?
Well, certainly Chris Wallace as moderator. We have seen President Trump just back in July in an interview with Chris Wallace where he talked about coronavirus and got fairly defensive, asking his staff to bring him the death chart to show a favored statistic about coronavirus deaths and a statistic that makes it look better. I will say that topics like the Supreme Court or having the topic of race and violence in our cities being framed as violence in our cities certainly puts it more in the territory of the way President Trump likes to talk about these issues. Vice President Biden prefers to talk about racial justice issues. So certainly both of them will have topics that have more of an advantage, COVID being more of an advantage for Biden. That's something that his campaign has focused on intensely, and President Trump's, they say, mishandling of the pandemic.
Yeah. And what about the New York Times reporting on President Trump's income taxes and debt? What kind of wild card do you think that might bring to this debate?
Well, it will inevitably come up. How President Trump responds to it, I think that we have seen some previews of this before because his taxes came up in the debates in 2016. What he said was not paying taxes made him smart. One other thing that he did, and I think that we can expect to see him do that again tonight, is to sort of dance around it, push it back. And in 2016, he said, well, Hillary Clinton was in the Senate and she created some of these tax laws, or she was involved in passing these tax laws. So, you know, it's her fault. She's been in government. I'm just playing the game. Well, you expect him to turn that on Joe Biden in a very similar way because Biden was in the Senate for a really long time. Trump still behaves, even though he's president of the United States and has been for 3.5 years, he still approaches a lot of things as an outsider and wants to paint himself as an outsider and Biden as an insider.
Well, you know, to that point, Tam, and if the past 4 years are any guide, if the 2016 debates were any guide, this one is likely to include some personal attacks. How do you expect that to play out and how Joe Biden might respond to it?
Yeah, and I think when we say personal attacks, we can expect them most likely to come from President Trump. His campaign sent out a memo today saying, here are the top questions for Joe Biden. And the top one was about Biden's son, Hunter Biden. And I think it will be really interesting to see how Joe Biden responds to this, whether he responds to it at all, or whether he sort of looks straight in the camera and says, America, is this what you care about right now? 200,000 people have died of coronavirus.
A lot of Americans have already voted, or they're going to vote really soon. So I mean, this is an interesting time, right? Are the candidates running out of time to change people's mind?
Well, recent polling would indicate there aren't that many minds to change. You know, the reality is people people have strong opinions about President Trump for and against. And the share of voters that are undecided is somewhere in the 7 to 12-ish% range, depending on how you look at it. And the number of them who are in battleground swing states is even lower. Although a lot of people will be watching this debate, fewer will be truly targeted by these candidates.
That's right. We'll see if their performance actually matters. Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent in Cleveland. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, today, Olivia Troy, the former top advisor to Vice President Mike Pence on the Coronavirus Task Force, described an attempt to find data about COVID-19 and kids. Here she is on CNN.
People within the White House specifically tasking more junior level staff to try to find alternate data, data that fit the narrative that they wanted, which was it only affects, you know, people above the age of 75 and it doesn't affect younger school children. It was all part of the narrative of we need to open up these schools. We need to open them up now.
Olivia Troy recently went public with quitting her job over concerns that President Trump was lying about COVID-19. Today, a New York Times report includes documents and interviews with other current and former officials who also said there was political pressure on the CDC to support President Trump's agenda to reopen schools and the economy, even as COVID-19 spread. Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Doctor, your thoughts. Is there alternative data saying it's safe for kids to go to school or that kids can't get COVID, which we also hear from this administration?
Well, I think that what we've known about this virus to date is that the risk to children is not zero by any means, but we are probably less worried about children in school environments than we are about the adults who have to go to school, so the teachers and the staff. And so part of the challenge in reopening schools is really as much about trying to protect the adults in those environments as well. But of course, the allegation and the assertion that there was political interference in the review of the data and discussing the known and unknown risks is, of course, deeply troubling.
Now, just explain to people, because in the last several months, we've gotten used to this sort of combative relationship among some of the health officials. How unusual is this, an administration putting political pressure on the CDC in a pandemic?
This is incredibly unusual. I mean, of course, there's always a temptation to intervene in the matters of science, particularly when the science is not necessarily aligning with the message that an administration is willing to send. But the level of intervention that we're seeing, you know, going so far as to author documents that then get published on the CDC's website that weren't even written by the CDC, I mean, I don't know of any time in which that has happened. And that's really deeply troubling because although the goal of reopening schools and trying to get children back into a learning environment, that's an important one for sure. But we have to make sure we're doing so based on the evidence that we have. And certainly the perception of political intervention is not going to make people feel reassured about doing that. And I think that ultimately harms and delays that goal.
Well, we've seen the FDA come out and have to make a strong statement about how they're going to extend the time period during which a vaccine might be tested. One of their goals there was to get some more confidence in a future vaccine. Of course, the president said that was political. But I'm imagining that you might have some contact with some of these people. Are people worried about an erosion of faith in what they ask people to do, like take a vaccine when it comes out?
Sure. So it's really important, I think, that the FDA came out and trying to define the scientific criteria that need to be met in order to allow a vaccine to be used. And that's really important because polls have showed that the majority of Americans believe that the vaccine will be made available before the data are there to support its use. And that's really unfortunate because a vaccine is potentially one of the most important tools we can use to combat this virus, but it's only going to work if people believe that it's not harmful to them. And so we need to make sure that we can preserve that trust and make sure that the data are what lead in terms of the making available the vaccine.
Yeah. And just it is so important for children to have not just the learning, but the socialization that comes with school. And yet it is so important that all the adults that work around them and the children, but all the adults, not just the teachers, but the staff, that they are safe as well. What advice do you give? New York City is beginning in-person learning just this week, but superintendents and principals are calling for a takeover of the schools. They don't trust the reopening plan. What's your overarching thought about children going back to school?
Sure. So, I mean, it really depends on individuals and their individual circumstances and what their risk factors are. As a parent of a young child, if my son's school was open, I would feel comfortable sending him, but we don't have high risk factors in particular to worry about. That said, I know that his going to school is only going to be beneficial if his teachers and staff are happily there. And if they are there against their will, that's not going to be a conducive learning environment for anyone. So although I think New York is well poised to reopen schools, given where their case numbers are, they clearly need to do more to assure the teachers and the staff that they're going to be safe in these environments. And that might mean further strengthening their safety protocols. The point is not to have people come back against their will, but to make sure that everybody feels confident about being there.
Dr. Jenna Rinuzzo, epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Dr. Nuzzo, thanks as always.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Older voters in the key state of Florida appear to be moving away from President Trump. In 2016, the president swept that demographic in Florida and across the nation. But polls suggest that Joe Biden is pulling many of them back to the Democratic Party. Voters 60 and older turn out at the highest rates in every election. And in Florida, where Trump and Biden are polling neck and neck, they could be decisive this year. So we wanted to speak with three seniors across the state. First, Randy Lascote in Melbourne, Central Florida. Randy, welcome.
Thank you.
And we have James Arms in Palm Coast. That's in Northern Florida. James, good to speak with you.
Thank you.
And Teresa Gavalda in Kendall in South Florida. Teresa, hello.
Hello.
And I want to ask all three of you just to start by giving me a little information about yourself, your background, and how you see yourselves politically. Teresa, why don't you start?
I'm 79 years old. I've been in Florida since 1953. And when I became a citizen, I registered to vote Republican. But then I went to Democrat, and I've been a Democrat ever since.
Well, let's go a little north to Randy up in Central Florida in Melbourne. Randy, tell us about yourself.
Okay, yeah, I'm a retired meteorologist from the National Weather Service, and I've lived in Florida since 1986. I describe myself politically as I was born a Democrat. I was born in Illinois, and when I started paying a lot of taxes, I kind of trended towards the Republican side. And now as I retired, I don't want to be a staunchy old grump, so I see myself more middle of the road now, I think. I like to, say I want to progress in my character and my beliefs as I get older. I think that's a good trait to be, but it's hard to do sometimes. But
yeah, James Arms, how about you? Tell us about yourself.
I'm from Illinois originally myself. I lived there most of my life. Me and my wife moved here in 2009. I moved here basically to get out of Illinois because Illinois is such a liberal state. Even though they've had Republican governors, they're still run by the city of Chicago, and the Democrats run the state, and they ran all the business out of the state.
So, James, you came to Florida to get away from the liberals in Illinois. So as we could tell, there's a diversity of viewpoints among you. Let's talk about what's driving you to vote in 2020. Teresa, I assume you're voting for Joe Biden.
I am voting for Joe Biden. I've voted in every election since I became a citizen. To me, it's very important. I became 18 right after the elections in Cuba that had the revolution and brought in Fidel Castro, and I didn't like what I saw. I was very upset. I've voted every election. I have taught my kids and my grandchildren that they need to vote in every election. They have to have a say in their government.
It's interesting that you came from Cuba in the 1950s. You knew the Castro regime. What do you think when Republicans and conservatives say, Joe Biden is a socialist, Joe Biden's a radical leftist?
Well, my BA is in philosophy, so I learned what the difference between communism and Nazism and fascism, and people don't know what each one is.
Mm-hmm. What issues are driving you, James?
Well, for instance, the coronavirus, since they're trying to blame that on Trump because he said that it came from China, they said he's a racist. But the fact is, it did come from China, and he's not a racist. And I think he's done a fine job.
You think he's done a fine job responding to the coronavirus. Randy Lascote in Melbourne, Central Florida, what do you think? What do you think about the president's response to the coronavirus, and is it that the issue that's bringing you to the polls?
Well, not really. No, I mean, you know, everybody, you know, in hindsight, you know, you can look back and say you could have done better. But, I mean, my issues are, boy, you know, the last election, I didn't vote for either candidate because I thought they were both dividers. And that's my issue with, you know, President Trump. He should stay off Twitter and not say, you know, a lot of bad things about people. I think that, you know, that really extremely turns me off. I'm married to a Hispanic native of Chile, and the way he tore down immigrant people, it really, really got to me because all the women in my life, they all immigrated to this country. And so I'm leaning towards Biden because we just need, you know, somebody that's not going to, you know, be so harsh towards other people, you know, speak, you know, with a civil tongue.
Randy, I want to stay with you for just 1 minute because you're an important voter in Florida. The reason is because you did not support Hillary Clinton in 2016, but you're saying now that you're willing to come back over to the Democratic side to support Joe Biden. In theory, that could make a very big difference for the Democrats in this race. Is it more of a not voting for Donald Trump, or is it really that you like Joe Biden?
Well, it would be more a protest vote, I think. I mean, I'm a Catholic, and Joe Biden is a Catholic. So, you know,
he is
there
not.
Is some.
He's a Catholic in name only.
Well, no, faith is a very important part of his life, James. Why do you say that? Because he doesn't support.
Because he's not pro-life. And if you're not pro-life, you're not Catholic. You're lying. And to the other point, Biden says he's been in the office for almost 50 years, and he hasn't done one damn thing in 50 years. Nothing.
You know, if I may say something, Americans have no idea what it is to have a dictator.
You're gonna find out if Biden gets in, because I think you're gonna.
Well, I disagree with you, sir. I disagree with you, but that's not the point. I lived in Cuba during Batista. Americans don't know what can happen if you elect the wrong person. I respect everybody's choice. If you like Trump, I respect
it. Okay, I understand that. You get socialists in the United States, and you will never.
I am not a socialist, sir.
I want to keep this civil. Let's just keep talking about the issues here. What about healthcare? I mean, raise your hand over the radio if healthcare resonates for you. I know that's an important issue for many seniors around the country.
Yep,
it does. Not
I'm on Medicare.
Teresa, start with you, and then we'll move to James.
I'm a Medicare. I have the Medicare Advantage, and I'm very happy with it. I would favor Medicare for all, and I think it's appalling that, people don't have health insurance here, and it costs us an enormous amount of money.
James, tell me about your position on health care. I presume you believe President Trump would protect what you've got. He says he wants to replace the Affordable Care Act, but he's got no plan to replace it yet.
I believe he'll protect what we have, but I don't think that Obamaism is going to help us at all. I think that whenever they tried to push that Obama insurance through, a lot of people lost their insurance. They said that they'd be able to keep it. That was a lie.
As far as health care goes, I think our main problem is we have a health care cost crisis. I was kind of expecting, you know, that the last 4 years that we would have, you know, worked on the cost side of it more to make it cut down on costs. You know, you want everyone to be able to have some form of health care. So the question is, how do you do it and how do you pay for it?
So you're a conservative who's supporting Joe Biden. Do you think that Trump could get you where you need to be or where the country needs to be on health care?
I haven't heard anything from the president, really. I mean, it's not my biggest issue. I think what I hear from our Democratic candidates is that they're not going to raise my taxes.
That's a lie.
If they're not going to raise my taxes, I think I'm pretty comfortable in my retirement. And, you know, that's the one thing that can really scare a lot of elderly people. You know, they're on fixed incomes. If you start hearing, you know, taxes going up, you know, they're going to run.
Democrats get in.
Well, we'll see. Joe Biden has promised not to raise taxes on anyone making under $400,000 a year. But what I think we're hearing right now is just how polarized and how divided we are as a country, and we can hear that among the three of you. What's it like having these types of conversations with your friends and family?
I mean, I have some friends that are, you know, right off the edge of both parties, and I'm somewhere in between. Yeah, most of them I'm very comfortable.
James, what's it like for you to talk politics with your friends?
Well, I really think Trump has the best idea. It's just he wants to bring manufacturing back to the United States. And if he brought that back, everybody would have a job. He did put a lot of people to work. So I think that Mr. Trump is the best bet, period.
And your friends agree with you mostly?
My friends do, because my friends are mostly Republican,
yeah,
because they're all conservative.
Randy, what about you? Having uncomfortable conversations around the dinner table there? How's life over there and where in Melbourne?
My wife and I, we keep each other honest, I think. And as far as talking with my friends, we don't really get together that much anymore, you know, socially distance, maybe.
Because of the virus, yeah, of course.
Yeah, so it's in some ways that's maybe kept us from really getting at each other's throats as much, I think. Seems like it's like that on in the media, you know, everybody's at each other's throats, kind of like. And I think that, you know, it's terrible as a country. I want somebody that, you know, is going to, you know, bring some civility back to the discussion.
Listen, very briefly, I just want a one-word answer from all three of you. At this point in the election, with just 5 weeks to go, is there anything that could change your mind?
No.
Not me.
Not me.
Randy?
Yes.
What is it?
Oh, well, if, you know, there are plans for taxes going up, I don't want to hear that at all.
All right. Randy Lescote in Central Florida, James Arms in Northern Florida, and Teresa Gavalda in South Florida. Seniors in the swing state of Florida, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
More than a million people have now died from COVID-19 around the world, and there is no sign that the virus is slowing down. In fact, we spent the past few days looking at the second wave in Europe, and today we're going to check in on Spain. The BBC's Guy Hedgeco is in Madrid, and Guy, we've spoken recently with reporters in the UK and in France where it's bad, but where you are in Spain appears to be even worse. What are you seeing?
Yes, I mean, Spain is the worst European country, certainly in terms of total numbers of infections. It has now clocked just under 750,000 infections since the beginning of the pandemic. And over the summer, July, August, and now into September, the number of infections has been accelerating. And so there is very much a second wave now in Spain. The numbers of deaths that we're seeing at the moment and the number of hospitalizations are still well below the numbers that we were seeing back at the peak of the first wave in March and April. But those are climbing steadily. But at the moment, it's the numbers of infections we're seeing, which, for example, yesterday were 2,500 over the previous 24 hours. And we're seeing figures like that or larger figures than that each day coming in, adding to the total. And Madrid, where I am, is very much the epicenter of this second wave at the moment.
What's behind that? Is it people losing their vigilance? What's causing this spike?
Well, the feeling is that Spain had this very strict lockdown between March and the end of June. And then when that lockdown was lifted, there was a feeling that people relaxed just too much, both normal Spaniards and perhaps the authorities as well. And people were so desperate to get out and have something like a normal summer that they perhaps relaxed too much. And that has been attributed as a major factor. And as a result, there was a lot of movement by Spaniards within Spain from one region to another as they tried to have some kind of a normal summer vacation. And that, of course, carried the virus around once again. Also, Spain culturally has a lot of intergenerational contact between, for example, grandparents and grandchildren. That's seen as being a big factor as well in terms of passing it between the generations. So those are a couple of the factors that people have talked about.
Guy, tell me what the government is doing in response. It sounds like they're putting new rules in place, but it also sounds like those rules are being applied inconsistently. The rules may be different depending on what side of the street you're on in Madrid. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, since the lifting of those the national restrictions back at the end of June, the central government has devolved to local, regional governments the powers when it comes to introducing new restrictions when it is deemed necessary. This has happened now in Madrid, which is the biggest city in Spain, and it has become something of a political dispute as well, because the regional government has introduced restrictions in some areas of Madrid, areas where the infection rate is particularly high, but not in all areas. So you can be standing in the street, as you say, in a certain area of Madrid, and on one side of the street, all the bars and restaurants have to close at 10 p.m. They have to restrict the number of customers they have coming in. But on the other side of that same street, there may be no such restrictions except for people having to wear face masks. So those are the kinds of measures that we're seeing at the moment. The national government, the central government, believes those measures in Madrid are not tough enough, and it wants to see much tougher measures being applied across the whole of Madrid.
That's the BBC's Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. Guy, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, Peter.
Does hypnosis help solve crimes, or does it put innocent people in jail, maybe even to death? You might remember the hit documentary Thin Blue Line. In it, we hear about a flawed Texas case, in part because police used hypnosis on a witness.
She went through 2 weeks internal affairs. When she comes out, her testimony changes. She goes in saying one thing, she comes out saying another. Something happened. What? Oh, well, you know, we refreshed her memory.
Refreshed her memory through police-induced hypnosis. And now the Supreme Court may take up the technique in another case in which Texas State Police say they used hypnosis. And Charles Don Flores is appealing his conviction, arguing they used it on the only witness that put him at the scene during a home invasion and murder in 1998. It turns out that hundreds of officers have been certified to practice hypnosis in Texas since the 1980s. They call it a reliable tool. Reporter Lauren Magahi and her co-worker Dave Boucher spent more than a year investigating the practice for the Dallas Morning News. And Lauren joins us now from Austin, Texas. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
Distinguish as you do in your writing, there's stage hypnosis, you know, people who make you think you're walking on hot coals. There's therapy. This is not the same.
This is not. So people are probably most familiar with seeing hypnosis in TV shows and movies, you know, like The Manchurian Candidate. What we would think of as stage hypnosis. Most hypnotists are actually clinicians, physicians who use hypnosis in therapy, you know, for things like helping to ease anxiety or help people sleep better. But what we were talking about is completely separate from even those two different kinds of hypnosis. This is police using hypnosis on a crime victim or witness in an attempt to refresh their memory if they have forgotten some details about what happened to them.
Well, we'll get to what science says about that, but give us some examples of how it's used.
It was used after the JFK assassination. It was even used to investigate the Ted Bundy case.
Well, you say it's been used widely, but how many states are still using it? And what happens in Texas? Officers take a week training?
That's right. Police hypnosis was pretty popular in the 80s and even in the 90s. But it's largely fallen out of practice because more and more states, as you alluded to, have banned introducing testimony based on something that is said under hypnosis. But Texas, in the past few years, it's been used more than 50 times just by the Texas Rangers, which are, you know, the vaunted state investigators.
It's been used in Texas over 1,800 times since the 80s. And while the American Psychiatric Association supports hypnosis employed by trained healthcare professionals as a therapeutic tool, in other words, to help people overcome habits or cope with severe anxiety or maybe lose weight. There is research on whether or not it works to retrieve memories. And that research, if I've got this right in your reporting, shows that it may actually implant imaginary ideas or distort recollections, because we're reading elsewhere in some research that researchers say your brain doesn't record everything. It doesn't have every single memory in there. And so what? A witness might try to supply one?
Right. There are these four pitfalls that researchers say we deal with when we're talking about police using hypnosis to, quote unquote, refresh someone's memory. Subjects who believe they're hypnotized can be prone to suggestion. They can respond to cues from the hypnotist without even really realizing they're responding to cues. So they might be led to believe something that didn't actually happen. And then there's what you refer to in the research. They call it confabulation, literally filling in gaps in your memory with events that may have never occurred. And if there's no corroborating evidence in a case to show that something actually happened that someone remembered only under hypnosis, then there's really no way to know whether that memory was true or not. All of those factors, some of them are helpful when we're talking about therapy, because you can suggest that someone sleep better. You can suggest that someone stop smoking. But when you're talking about memory and what our brain actually retains, it can become highly problematic.
Well, that brings us to the Charles Don Flores story. Who is he and what's his involvement with this?
Charles Don Flores is on death row in Texas. He was convicted of being involved in the murder of a grandmother in North Texas more than 20 years ago now. He's appealed his case many times, and now he's trying to appeal it kind of in a Hail Mary to the U.S. Supreme Court. And one of the arguments he's making is that a key witness who testified against him, who placed him at the scene of the crime, was hypnotized to refresh her memory in the days after the crime. And him and his lawyers are arguing that has made her testimony in total unreliable.
Well, and further, there were two men who were accused in this really heinous crime, murdering this 60-something woman, stealing things from her home. Richard Lynn Childs, a white man, pled guilty to actually killing the woman. He was sentenced to 35 years, was released on parole in 2016. Flores was convicted under the law of parties. This is a Texas statute that lets accomplices be tried for the same crime as the perpetrator. Again, under hypnosis, this neighbor who saw two men go in said she thought it was him. Why is he up for the death penalty, but the actual perpetrator was not?
Richard Lynn Childs did agree to plead guilty, and so he was able to make a deal. Charles Don Flores would not plead guilty. He's said he is innocent. And because he would not admit blame, then he was given the maximum potential penalty for being involved in a crime of this nature in Texas, which is the death penalty. Yeah.
Well, in Charles Don Flores, there was circumstantial evidence. He was seen with the car that Richard Lynn Childs owned. He knew him. But there's nothing that's direct evidence, no fingerprints, nothing but the witness under hypnosis testimony.
That's right. There's no physical evidence tying Charles Don Flores to the murder scene or to the body of the woman who was killed. But the prosecutors say that the fact that he knew the man who pleaded guilty, that he was seen with him the same day as the murder, and that he ultimately fled the country, that's their argument, that he must have been involved in some way in the murder of this woman. He says that he did all of those things because he knew that they suspected his involvement and that he didn't have another option but to flee. He also has raised questions about why the white man in this case, who admitted to the murder, is already out and out of prison while he, an Hispanic man, remains on death row.
Well, then there's also the accuracy of the testimony under hypnosis. The witness described a medium-built man with long hair. Charles is short and pudgy. Doesn't look like he has any hair. What's at stake besides the life of Charles Don Flores? No small thing. But if, in fact, the Supreme Court, and it's going to be a far more conservative court, if they turn down hypnosis as the sole evidence in a murder case, Does that mean that Texas might stop? I mean, what's at stake here?
There's a lot at stake in this case. Obviously, for Charles Don Flores, it's his very life. But the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't revisited police using hypnosis as an investigative tool since the late 80s. Even at that time, they were split 5-4. They were close to finding that hypnosis was not a reliable tool. They could take up this case now and decide that courts should not be accepting testimony from people who have been hypnotized by law enforcement. In states like Texas, that would have a huge effect because at least at the top echelons of law enforcement, the Texas Rangers, sheriffs, they still use hypnosis regularly enough that they would then have to completely dismantle those programs. Even would probably have to take a look anew at any and all recent cases, inmates in Texas prisons who were put there using hypnosis. Or they could find that they believe that hypnosis is a perfectly fine tool. It's hard to say whether if the U.S. Supreme Court suddenly kind of gave the green light to hypnosis, whether it would be used. I think it would come down to whether prosecutors believe that that ultimately taints their case or makes their case more difficult to argue.
Lauren Magahi, a reporter for the Dallas Morning News, her team spent more than a year looking into the use of hypnosis in Texas law enforcement. Lauren, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
More than 30 states are offering in-person early voting this election season. And because of the pandemic, many will be directing voters for the first time ever to basketball arenas to cast their ballots. Kathy Behrens is here to tell us more about that. She's president of Social Responsibility and Player Programs for the National Basketball Association, the NBA. Kathy, welcome. Many people first heard about this plan back in August when the NBA and the players agreed to resume the playoffs after a brief pause that was following the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. What was the motivation to link racial justice protests to the use of NBA arenas for voting?
Well, it actually goes back farther than that because back in late June, the Atlanta Hawks had worked together with Fulton County to make State Farm Arena an early voting supercenter open to all county residents. We just knew that our facilities, whether it was the arenas or our practice facilities in some cases, could be made available as a really important resource for the community. So when we talked to the players in August about what we were doing, we were, I think, at 10, and some of our other teams were hard at work on this and knew it was a priority, and we just agreed with the players that we would do everything we could, and so we've now added 12 since then, so hopefully we can get a few more. There are obviously some markets where it just doesn't work for a variety of reasons, but
like the Toronto
we're really
Raptors,
excited about it. Toronto, right. Well, yeah. Although I will say what Toronto is hoping to do is to, and they have been doing this, to encourage, you know, they're using their platform to encourage Americans who are living in Canada to vote. And so we're taking advantage of all opportunities to share information about voting in a very truly nonpartisan way. So even in Toronto, they'll do that.
Sure. And if I'm doing my math right, then you have about 22 teams who've committed to doing this in some form or another. How's it going to work? And actually, why do you think it will help people vote during the pandemic?
Well, just because I think our facilities are so much larger. And so I know, for example, where I vote in New York, where I live, it's a small space. It can get crowded. And so to take advantage of our arenas, which are otherwise, not in great use right now for COVID reasons, we just think that people will feel more comfortable being in a larger building where people can really spread out. In some cases, our teams are already using their arenas for early voting or for nonpartisan voter registration. In San Francisco, the Golden State Warriors have used their building for poll worker training. So every team is looking for what their community needs.
It's a good intention, but it may not be easy. A former Florida elections official, Jenya Coulter, wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post this week with a warning, said that turning NBA arenas into polling places might be a disaster. She said that people coming to vote might not know where to go or whom they need to speak to say nothing of using multiple entrances into a polling room, which puts ballot security at risk. Have you thought about all this stuff and planned for the added risks that come with turning these arenas into polling places?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, we're not just waking up one day and turning open the building. This is well thought out. The plans for parking, driving, security, everything is being taken into account. And our teams are working hand in hand with their local election officials to make sure that everything is done the same way it would normally be done in any other kind of facility that's open and available for polling. So, again, we recognize, too, that some of this has started already. So in Oklahoma City, they've been doing voter registration for the last few Saturdays. Now, I realize that's not the same when you have secure ballots, but we can assure everyone that, that every possible precaution, every possible plan is being taken.
You know, anyone who follows sports know that sports are not about sports anymore, really, right? You know, it's like the NBA is involved in social justice movements. We're seeing even the WNBA, baseball, hockey, you know, all stage or support protests over racial justice this year. Where does this fit in, bigger picture, into the social initiatives that professional sports and the NBA are engaging with now?
Well, it certainly, I think, fits in well with, there's nothing more American than participating in the democracy and making sure that the democracy works. And again, I believe whether it's in the NBA or the WNBA or our G League, where we have a number of facilities in the G League are also going to be available, we really have encouraged everybody to understand that they've got a role to play and that our platform can be used for good. That's how our players feel. That's how our teams feel. And so I think this is just another extension of that.
Have you committed to doing this beyond 2020? Like, will we be voting in arenas in 2024?
You know, certainly there's aspects of this that are related to COVID and to the ongoing pandemic. And so we'll have to see how all of that goes. And hopefully it won't be needed. But if they are, I know our teams will step up.
That's Kathy Behrens, President of Social Responsibility and Player Programs for the NBA, talking about turning arenas into voting centers. Kathy, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
And you know they can turn a basketball court into a hockey rink in a few hours, so a voting booth should be easy, right?
No problem.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. President Trump and Joe Biden meet for the first debate amid rising COVID-19 numbers and new revelations about President Trump's financial situation. We'll review the debate next time here and now.